Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, and I shall be hosting the show as usual. The show is named after the charity I founded 16 years ago to help people with cancer to access the benefits of integrative medicine. If you want to know more about the charity, Yes to Life, then take a look at yestolife.org.uk. Today, I have a very interesting new guest for you, new in as much as she's never been on the Yes to Life show before. Toral Shah is a nutritional scientist who has herself had cancer. But unlike many who train in nutrition following treatment for cancer, Toral was already trained when diagnosed. I'm very interested to hear about her own decision-making processes as she passed through the various stages of dealing with cancer. I'm talking to Toral over the internet. Welcome to the Yes to Life show, Toral.
Thank you for having me. I know we've been talking about doing this for a very long time. It's great to finally be here.
We have. Lovely to have this chance to chat. So you're a nutritional scientist, a functional medicine practitioner, food and health writer and consultant, and the founder of the Urban Kitchen. So I've read that you initially wanted to be an oncologist. So what prompted that thinking and what made you change direction?
So what prompted that thinking was when I was 11 years old, I was quite precocious and I read a book about a cancer surgeon.
Really?
And an oncologist.
Wow.
And I was like, right. And he worked with adolescents and I was like, right, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to cure cancer. Mm-hmm. And obviously at that age, I had no idea what an oncologist was, the difference between these jobs. But I did know I always wanted to work with cancer and I was going to cure it. At 11, you can do any of these things.
You can.
Obviously, as you get older, you realize you could. Maybe that's not the way. So the first step was for me, and I never really considered the research originally because I really love people. So for me, kind of the pathway was, okay, I'll just go to medical school and I'll be an oncologist. And then I'll save all these people. And I got to medical school and it was a bit of a rude awakening, understanding what oncology job actually was. Right. And really kind of facing it in real life, because my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was at medical school and going with her to all appointments, I just suddenly thought, I don't know if I could do this job because it involves seeing a lot of patients, some of them are very ill, some of them are not quite so ill, but giving them drugs, seeing them kind of suffer, and not really being in control of what happens at the other end, and just being part of that, and not really be able to kind of alleviate any of that stuff either. So I suddenly thought, hang on a second, I need to be able to keep myself more positive. And I think when you're working with patients, you give them a lot of your energy. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly realized that in the oncology field, like being able to separate yourself from your patients is a really important skill. And I don't think I'm very good at that. I'm very empathetic. And I'm not saying that oncologists aren't, they are, but like I get very involved with people. And so I suddenly realized that that wasn't the right pathway for me.
Okay.
And it actually made me feel quite disillusioned because my mom went through, surgery, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, hormone treatment, and nowhere was anyone talking about how to recover from all of these things and how to kind of deal with the side effects and how to do it. It was all about just the treatment. And then when she got to the end, I was a bit like, okay, you're kind of spat out at the other end of the system. And what do you do next? How do you get back to your life? Mm. And that's when I started really researching, looking at nutrition and lifestyle and cancer, which we weren't being taught at medical school, which is still not really being taught at medical school.
Yeah.
And that's where my interest came in.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that all makes sense. So now here you are deeply immersed in the world of nutrition for health, but you've also had your own health challenges, which we are going to be talking about today. So what part did your own personal experience play in your career choices? Did that also help you along the way, or did it all come from helping your mother?
It really came from helping my mother, because after I left medical school, I worked in research for a while in Salk oncogenes, and then I had a break from science. Then I went back and did the master's in nutritional medicine. So that was well before any health concerns that I had. And when I was finishing the master's in nutritional medicine, that's when I found a lump, and I eventually was diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 29.
Wow.
It wasn't something I expected. I did know that at some point in my life, I may have to deal with breast cancer because my mom's sister had it and loads of my cousins have had it. And there's definitely a familial link in our family. But I didn't think I would have to deal with it at that young age. It was a massive shock.
I imagine.
And I'd already done I'd done the taught part, the master's. The only thing I had to do was write my thesis. So the only thing, it was a big thing. But so really, until then, it didn't influence it, but it made me even more passionate. So my thesis was going to be on diabetes. I'd done all this research, but I actually changed and asked them if we could do something on looking at diet and lifestyle interventions into the kind of prevention of or risk reduction of breast cancer and you know, reducing risk of reoccurrence. And that's kind of what my master's thesis was about at the end. So it did shift it at that point, but I was already on that pathway to do that. And that was back in 2006. So it's been 15 years that I've kind of been part of this cancer community as both a professional and a personal note. But sadly, I've had two reoccurrences since, one in 2018 and one at the end of 2020. So during the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, and that's been tough. Really tough.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll talk a bit more about that. I'm really wanting to explore this situation where you've got a highly trained specialist and how do they respond to their own situation. We've heard a little bit about your diagnosis. Can you tell us about the treatment choices you made and why you made them?
So, first of all, I have to reiterate that most younger women have quite aggressive, fast-growing breast cancer, and I didn't have that, and that was unusual in itself. Mm. I had more of a postmenopausal type that grew slowly, but it was very hormone positive, so basically it grew in response to estrogen, progesterone. So the cancer itself, when I was first diagnosed at 29, most of it was something called ductal carcinoma in situ, which means it's cancer, which is mainly stuck into the milk ducts of your breast, and I had a few areas where there was stage one cancer, but again it was very contained. There was no spread to my lymph nodes, it wasn't really spread outside the tissue, so the decisions I made were very much based on working with my team. And I actually ended up, I think the first decision was changing team. So I was at a local hospital near my parents' house in Croydon, and I decided to find a different team. And that was the first kind of decision. And that was based on my knowledge, because I just thought, I want someone who specializes in younger women. So after seeing many consultants and many teams, I was really lucky to find a really, really, really great pair of people at the Royal Marsden. And that really helped me, because both Mr. Gwee and Mr. Searle, who Mr. Searle's actually retired now, especially as younger women, plus they were very empathetic and they spent quite a lot of time listening to me and what my concerns were and my needs. Mm. And that was really important. So as it turned out, I needed to have a mastectomy. So that was the biggest kind of decision. I had a lumpectomy, it wasn't enough. And for me, that was really tough, because I didn't want to lose part of my body at that age. But having those two surgeons and knowing they were going to do the best for me and knowing that they understood how I felt about it or how devastated I was, it really helped. And in the end, you know, we went through several kind of reiterations of what we were going to do surgically. In the end, I had a mastectomy and I literally just had an implant. And then we looked at all the figures they did, and their whole thought process is so contained that, is it worth giving you chemotherapy or radiotherapy? And they decided not, and I agreed with that. And then the thing then to do was hormone treatment, tamoxifen. Now, unfortunately, I wasn't able to tolerate that, so I lasted probably 7 weeks, I can say on that. Yeah. And then because no one was able to help me with the side effects in those days, I actually kind of just gave up and then didn't really think about it for the next 12 years. Because with young women and younger patients and with breast cancer, if you're going to have a recurrence, it often happens within the first 5 to 10 years. So I'm past that 10-year mark, but woohoo, I'm done now. Right. Bye. You know, I never have to think about this again. Yeah. But a couple of years later, I was diagnosed again with, you know, and again, this came from me feeling something wasn't right. So, the reoccurrence actually occurred in the mastectomy scar. And all I could say was, it just feels different. And I couldn't think, there was nothing else apart from it just felt different. Mm. And again, it took a long time to be diagnosed. And in that instance, again, we had it removed. They just removed the tumor. It was quite tiny, like less than 2 centimeters. And the discussion again was, do we do chemotherapy or not? And the The radiologist that I have, she's specialised again in younger people, and she, her thought process was, again, it was very contained, it hadn't spread anywhere, it had small, that it was quite near, probably a little bit nearer to my heart than she would have liked. So any radiotherapy may have gone in over my lungs and heart, and it didn't make sense to give me radiotherapy. And this discussion went on in their MDTs for about 2 months, like whether or not to give radiotherapy. And I was happy to do it. And in the end, we decided to try tamoxifen again. And again, I struggled with that. And then this year, well, 2020, sadly, it came back again in the second scar of the kind of where they'd done surgery, and it was a bit bigger. And so because it's come up for the third time, we decided to be a little bit more radical. So the options were radiotherapy and chemotherapy and hormone treatment. Now, understanding my body, and I'm not saying everyone should do this, but understand my body, understand how cancer progresses, how it moves or how it works. I had several consultations with both my own team and with another team at UCL, and I decided not to do chemotherapy, but to have a more radical treatment of radiotherapy, meaning doing a much bigger area to stop any spread. Because I've never had radiotherapy before, and that's a really great first-line treatment. And so that's where we're at right now. Because it, again, it hadn't spread to the lymph nodes. It had touched part of the sort of implant capsule, but other than that, everything was removed. So theoretically, everything was removed by surgery, and then we were using radiotherapy to kill any sort of stray cells. It never seems to, touch wood, have got into my bloodstream or try to move around and metastasize in that way. And I'm touching wood. So I'm hopeful that that's enough. Plus, the biggest thing that we kind of looking at some of these databases and the predict tool, which helps you to discuss what kind of treatment, although it is based on primary cancer rather than recurrence, was that hormone treatment was going to be way more important for me than chemotherapy. The benefit of chemotherapy was, of the cancer coming back, was between 1.8 and 3.2%, whereas the hormone treatment was between 6.5% and 8%. So focusing on the hormone treatment has been really a big thing. And because I've never been able to tolerate it, we've kind of gone for a quarter dose, which I'm able to tolerate with a lot of support. And we're going to just kind of really focus on that, because that, we know that that really stops cancers, hormone positive cancer like mine, from growing. And, you know, from the functional perspective, there's a whole load of other things that I've looked at, I'm really lucky.
I bet. Yeah. All right, we're going to look into that in a second. I just go back over some of what you said? Very interested to hear you looking for your team there. I mean, quite often I come across people who have gone in, been diagnosed, had their first appointments, thought, oh my God, I can't deal with these people, and have gone off to look for another team, and that's the reason why. And probably they're looking for some of the same things as you, but it's kind of the bad experience that's prompted them to make the investigation. Now, you're saying, in a way, you weren't going to be satisfied unless you found a team who really specialised in your situation, as well as having lots of empathy and all the rest of it. And that was a kind of proactive first thought of yours. Is that right?
Yes. Once I realised I was going to have a mastectomy, I also realised, this is back in 2006, where immediate reconstruction wasn't done in a lot of hospitals. So first thing was, I want immediate reconstruction. The second thing is, I want as many reconstruction opportunities as possible so I can get the best result. And the local hospital didn't have that. They didn't have the same plastic surgery services. They just didn't have those opportunities to just have those kind of discussions. And for me, that was a big part of it. And originally, I have to be honest, I was looking for a female surgeon. All right. And so I wanted someone who could really understand what it felt like. And actually, in the end, I'd end up with a fully male team, and they're brilliant. But that was my first thought process. And then the original surgeon I had was my mum's surgeon and oncologist, that team. And I just was like, you know what? You already have spent years not listening to me and not laughing at me, but like feeling annoyed by me. There's not a good dynamic here. Because I was already bringing up the nutrition and all the kind of lifestyle elements back in 1999.
That must have been very popular.
I was not popular. So I think I needed a fresh start. And I think that's, even this time around, the oncologist I had at the Marsden, there wasn't a good relationship with us, and I asked for a different one, and that's been helpful. I think starting fresh and kind of being able to look at it from a different angle has really helped.
So How much would you encourage other people to do that kind of exercise? How important has it been to you in the success of your treatment or the progress of your treatment? Is it something you'd recommend everybody does a bit of an investigation into who they want to do their treatment?
I think it's very personal. I think for me, for some people, all they want to do is get the treatment done quickly and out the way and move, get through the process. For someone like me, having a relationship, knowing that cancer's never just done at the end of the treatment, it is a whole other kind of process. Mm. It was really important. And I do think that you are entitled under the NHS to have a second opinion. Mm-hmm. So feel free to use that, because sometimes having more confidence, we know that having confidence and being positive can affect your physical state and your psychological state. So if you're going to have more confidence in your team, that's going to potentially affect you. So for me, that was really important. For some people, it won't be as important. But for me, I think, and I can't quantify how much it made a difference, but I do feel supported. And when things haven't worked, because on this occasion, there have been some issues, and I know we'll talk about it in the second perspective, in the second part of the kind of conversation, but it has meant having a relationship where people have known me. And essentially, some of these doctors and team have seen me grow up because they've been around in my life for 15 years. And, mm-hmm. And that has helped, because they also know, like some of the people that I've worked with for longer, they know I'm not a hypochondriac. I just don't turn up unless they're really, I think there's 100% an issue. And I've been right every time, even when they said, no, there's nothing wrong with you. So I think building that trust is so important.
Hmm. Well, that thing you've just described, having been a parent of someone with cancer, I've come across it so many times it would drive you mad that doctors don't listen to the people telling their own story, and it includes when it's a parent knowing that there's something wrong with their child. It's exactly the same. And there's such a lesson in that, because, I mean, you know, late diagnosis is one of the rampant issues in Britain, and it has been for years. It's identified by the government as a major problem, a major issue. And I think that's one of the reasons, the big reasons, is that people just don't listen. They think, they're just complaining, it's nothing. You know, it needs addressing.
Well, let me tell you my own actual original story of diagnosis. So, bear in mind, my mother's had breast cancer. My aunt, my maternal aunt, my mother's sister's had breast cancer. Mm. I went to my GP, and he was actually a really close family friend and is still a very close friend. And he was retiring. He said, listen, why don't you see the new female GP next week? I was like, okay, great. Saw the new female GP, and she just didn't really take me seriously, despite knowing that we had a family history. And she put in a kind of request, but it wasn't an urgent cancer request, which it should have been. And in the end, because my mother is medical, works in the hospital, she works in the radiography, she ended up somehow kind of getting me an appointment kind of the other way around, which is, you know, can't really happen normally. But and then once I had that kind of biopsy, I was really clear that that was probably the answer. But when I told her I was diagnosed, she just basically just, because A, she didn't really believe me, and B, she just kind of ignored what I was saying and the urgency of it. And so that did mean that there was a delay in my original diagnosis, which is frustrating. And I'm an articulate, educated medical person who knows how the system works. How does everyone else navigate this? Exactly. I mean, I also know my body well. I'm an expert in, you know, my body. I know a lot about cancer by this point. How do other people navigate it? You know, if I didn't have my mother's support and, like, appreciation, because she's been through it, she knew exactly what she was talking about, who to push and da-da-da. Like, how would I have been diagnosed? Maybe it would have been a few months later. Maybe then it would have become more aggressive. How do we know that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've had some absolutely gruesome personal experiences of being completely ignored in that way, and, you know, by people who should know better. And it's a difficult thing. And I'm not quite sure what the answer to it is. What, you know, there's something sadly lacking in the education or something, which is just, not making people look out for what's the worst thing this could be, rather than, it's probably nothing. Because that's...
I think it's our whole system that GPs are overworked, overstretched. They get 10 minutes each person, so they almost don't have time to think. I think that's part of the problem. And I'd like to think that in 15 years that it would have improved, but it hasn't. It's got worse, as you've alluded to. And, right. You know, with the COVID pandemic, it's become even worse. And it terrifies me, because there's so many people that are going to have very poor outcomes, if any outcome at all, because, you know, they may die because of these delays. And, you know, we are a G7 country, one of the kind of richest countries in seven countries in the world, yet we're the only country that's decreased kind of financial contributions to our kind of health system and decreased investment in it. And then the outcomes are now very different in countries which are probably not quite as wealthy, but they're looking at, have a different system essentially, or decentralized system, like Germany or Spain or somewhere like that. So perhaps, I just think we need a massive overhaul of NHS and also a medical school training too.
Yeah, well, I think you're right about GPs. It's definitely a problem there. But unfortunately, I've encountered it also amongst oncology professionals. So when I say people who really should know better, that's what I'm referring to. The same kind of complacency, which won't actually even do a proper diagnosis and check. So anyway, that's a bit of a, you know, personal bugbear, but let's carry on and talk about your situation now. So you've been through lots of different phases of treatment along the way, I'm sure, from kind of aggressive to maintenance. And I'd just be interested to hear how you've approached these different phases, because, as you say, you're a professional yourself and you've had lots of your own input, no doubt, into handling all these phases.
So, you know, again, I need to own that I've not had chemotherapy, so I don't have personal experience. I know that's one of the hardest things. I have had radiotherapy. So with the radiotherapy, my request was to do them in the afternoon or lunchtime onwards, because I know from the research that exercising in a couple of hours before radiotherapy can help reduce your side effects.
Right.
And so they were able to accommodate me with that. Excellent. And I rented a, because obviously this is when peak lockdown, so I couldn't go anywhere. I was by myself at home. I rented a spin bike, and I basically did that every day before I went for radiotherapy. Now, I can't tell you whether that helped or not, because obviously I'm not, I don't have a control. But I mean, from what I've spoken to other people, it definitely did help with some of the aspects of fatigue but just with my breathing and things like that, because, you know, essentially my lungs and my chest were being irradiated. So it kept me moving. It kept me, and I did hit a wall at nighttime in the evening, but it did keep me kind of feeling relatively normal until that I hit that wall at 5:30 or 6 p.m. So that was great. It meant I could work for the first few weeks of radiotherapy.
Right.
And then I ended up being tired on my breaks. That helped. I think knowing to keep hydrated, knowing what to eat has had a, you know, hopefully helped as well. And also the psychological, the psychosomatic things, like in the breath work, the meditation, the psychological support. I also took some medicinal mushrooms from a brand called Hifestarterra to help with the side effects of radiotherapy and chemotherapy. They have got published results in radiotherapy and chemotherapy and breast cancer. And they have a special preparation for anyone who has had breast cancer. And the results are actually really pretty good. They're testing out in 5 hospitals in Spain currently with patients in phase 3 clinical trials. So for me, that's very positive. One of the things they haven't published on is the support with hormone treatment. But I, from my personal, from seeing some of their data, there is some evidence to show it can help. But from a personal perspective, every time I stopped taking the mushrooms, the really bad side effects I was having from the hormone treatment, tamoxifen, come back. So there's something in that, whether it's psychosomatic, I don't care. I just, it helps me. So I'm taking those things. I think also just being able to give myself the space to heal, both physically, spiritually, emotionally, has been really important. And I don't think it's something we talk about in traditional or allopathic medicine, that kind of thing. And I think having Catherine Zalman of Penny Braun as a kind of personal kind of confidant that I could speak to about these topics really helped. And having someone who's so knowledgeable in this integrative oncology field at my kind of fingertips, and plus knowing, you know, quite a lot of other people in the field, massively helped. Because it's one thing when you're working with patients, but it's the second thing when you're working with yourself.
It is.
So those are the kind of things I did.
Yeah, so in terms of, if we talk about, I mean, quite often people are encouraged to find themselves a bit of a team if they've got a diagnosis to support them in these different ways, different types of people. You just described one team member there, Catherine, who's obviously been very useful to you. Who else has been in your team?
Great question. So I have an amazing osteopath stroke physical therapist called Kirsty Cousins, who's actually a lecturer in anatomy and all sorts of things. She's just phenomenal. And she's been through the journey with me for the last, I think, 7 or 8 years, because I have a lot of scar tissue and I have a lot of pain from kind of all the surgery. And she helps to manage that both in the acute times like now and also the times when it's just maintenance. Yeah. And it helps to keep me moving. And we all know that movement and exercise is so important for so many aspects of physical and mental health. I've had a fantastic exercise physiologist called Tom, who specialised in rehabbing people post-cancer surgery and treatment. And that's helped because it has meant that I've been able to feel safe about moving, because I've had a diet flap, which means they took some massive amount of skin, fat, blood vessels from my tummy and they've transplanted it to my chest to make a breast. And it basically breaks your core, essentially. So I really needed a lot of rehabilitation with that, and that's been super helpful. I've had the hypnosterapia team with the medicinal mushrooms. I have the most amazing psychotherapist and who specialised in cancer. Her husband had prostate cancer and sadly died in the middle of the COVID pandemic, and she's been kind of absolutely key part of the team. I felt some really good friends and family. My best friend's a yoga teacher. She works for Apple. And, you know, her just giving me some gentle movement and stretches to do. Again, the same with the movement for Modern Life team. They've been brilliant. Having a psychologist friend, Paul Sheroux, who not only came and stayed after surgery, but also kind of has been talking about the psychological aspects that maybe I don't necessarily talk about with the therapist. Not because I don't want to, just because of the time frame. And some of it's just two friends just chatting. that's helped. So they have. Yeah. I've had a massive team, and I think, having had all those people in place and knowing them all before this happened to me again, also made life a lot easier.
Yeah.
In what was a difficult time in lockdown, when it would be hard to find people because you couldn't meet people face to face and all of that thing.
No, you're absolutely right. It would be difficult. You've definitely got an advantage from just being in that world in the first place, obviously. And that's fantastic. But nonetheless, I'm sure you'd encourage anybody to get out there and look for that kind of support for themselves where they feel they need it.
100%. I think that's really the great thing about the Yes to Life, because you've got a nice directory of people. I think hopefully within the kind of British Society of Integrative Oncology, we'll have a kind of more of a directory there. Mm. I think working in the field and knowing people has meant I'll be able to pick people's brains on an informal basis. And also just check in, okay, I've chosen this, what do you think? And that's been helpful too.
Mm. Right. Very good. Okay, so one last thing maybe before we move on, because as you mentioned, we've got another topic we want to cover today. I'm just interested to know, what are the ways in which your thinking, your approach have developed in direct response to your own experience?
I think my original response was very much about the kind of physical aspects, so the nutrition, the sleep, the exercise, supplements, all of those things. And I think, having been through it myself on 3 occasions now, in the second 2 occasions, that kind of psychological aspect, the spiritual aspect, the emotional, mental, has become very important. Because I understand that if you're stressed, you release cortisol, our stress hormone. And if we're under chronic stress, which many of us are in this modern crazy life, that can impact inflammation. It can impact a whole lot of disease. And we just don't know enough about that. But being able to tap in, and something that Catherine Zalman and I really talked about, particularly this time, is that kind of understanding that maybe there is work for me to do with healing emotional trauma that I've been through in the past, and that there is trauma. And I don't mind sharing that the first time I was diagnosed with breast cancer, the year and about 18 months before, I had a horrible breakup with a partner that I thought I was going to marry and have a family with. So that was really difficult for me. And in 2018, there was something similar, and there was something similar with the same person in this time round too. And I do see that I hadn't really maybe linked those traumatic experiences, emotional experiences, with my own health. And now I can see that there may be something that we need to look at, and maybe we just don't understand enough about this kind of aspect of our emotions and our experiences and our trauma and stress on our bodies and what it does to it. So that is an area that I'm focusing a lot on, and it's about creating my own boundaries and be able to say no and yes in a different way, and really focus on my kind of healing, which is a new experience in some ways.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I feel like the science behind that kind of thing, the association between trauma and physical illness like cancer, is beginning to appear now. I mean, it's being done. People are beginning to look into these things. There's a lot more interest, and people are coming up with some interesting stuff, which looks like it just confirms these suspicions everybody's had for a very long time, that there seems to be, what a coincidence, that person's had, you know, a family member died a year and a half before, 2 years before. That's absolutely typical time frame, isn't it? And I know I was aware of it for myself. I actually thought when my daughter died, I thought, blimey, I could actually get cancer after this because it could have such an effect on my body. And so I actually took steps to avoid that. I'm glad to say I didn't seem to get cancer, so that's good. But it is something for people to be conscious about, I think, is the effect on their immune system, particularly of going through a trauma, how it, you know, we actually know now it does suppress the immune system. That's one of the things it does. So I'm sure there are steps.
And so many others.
Yeah, I'm sure there are steps that could be advised to people in those situations.
And I think that's where, like, the wonderful thing, as you shared, was that there is more research into this field. And personally, I want to go and do a PhD. And I had this PhD idea before I was re-diagnosed this time, but was looking at, kind of anecdotally, when I speak to young women in particular, they've had some this trauma, as we discussed, 18 months or 2 years before. And what I've realized by understanding the stress, kind of how we kind of process stress and the stress hormones in our body and the estrogen in our bodies. So when we have estrogen, men and women have it, but, you know, women have more, and we need to use it, bind it, break it down, and then kind of expel it from our bodies. Now, there's a bit of an overlap between the kind of breaking down the stress hormones and this estrogen detoxification. And it sort of seems to look like, and we've got to do the research, and that's why I'm really keen on looking at this further, is that if you have a lot of stress and the enzymes that you use that and the kind of micronutrients which are needed for cofactors, it can overwhelm the estrogen detoxification cycle. So that bill builds up, and that's why, you know, more young women have these estrogen positive breast cancers. There are also a whole lot of women who have triple negative breast cancers, and which means they have no hormones involved, and those people often have poorer outcomes, and they seem to be younger as well. So there's a whole kind of variety, and I think there's, again, a lot of research there.
Very much so. Anyway, very interesting topic. All right, onward. So something else that you're extremely passionate about is health inequalities in cancer care in the UK, but probably everywhere, but there, you're obviously particularly concerned with at home here. Now, on this show, we've recently heard from a representative of Black Lives Matter campaign, and we've also had a bit of a perspective on the problems that the Muslim community face in an earlier show. So it's quite clear from them that there are persisting issues. I mean, on the other hand, with a more positive spin on it, I kind of feel there's some movement in the right direction, but I just thought I'd ask you, how does it seem to you?
So I think it's a really topical conversation. So health inequalities, and not just in cancer, are, unfortunately, there's a real disparity between the Black Asian ethnic minority groups and white people in the UK. If you look at the Runnymede Trust and the Council of Macmillan, they've actually researched this. There's not enough data, but they have researched some of this, and you can see the clear outcomes. And what means, and I think you alluded to this earlier, some of these groups who don't have as much health education or awareness, or don't attend screening, or, you know, don't have that information at the hands, they are often diagnosed very late, which does mean they often have poorer outcomes and are more likely to die. Now, in both Black and South Asian women, there's a lot of data, there's a bit more data, and we definitely need to collect more data. And that's one of the kind of key issues in this field, is to understand why there's disparities there, but also, like, how can we improve them? But unless we know the baseline, how are we going to get any better? So, and also how much of the information is inclusive? Because a lot of the diet and lifestyle information is very much geared towards a kind of white Caucasian diet and lifestyle. And so it's that information. Our medical students, medical students are a very mixed bunch in the UK, and doctors in the UK, actually, there's more kind of South Asian and Chinese doctors than others.
Yeah.
But it's the actual advice that's given by all the kind of other professionals and even the oncologists. And I think that's where we need to start kind of doing the research. So, for example, if we take clinical trials, very few people, minorities, Black, Asian, ethnic minorities, enter clinical trials. So how are we going to do the research for things to improve? A lot of the drugs aren't even tested. And obviously, we do have, essentially, we actually have more genetic differences within our own groups, ethnic groups, than we do between white and Black. And, so we need to just put that aside. But from, obviously, there are different genes that can make an impact on how health issues appear. For example, let's just take vitamin D. In the UK and kind of other northern European countries, we're vitamin D deficient anyway. Hmm. All cancers, if you test most people with cancer, they'll be vitamin D deficient. And it's just a kind of thing over whether you're white, Black, pink or purple, it doesn't matter. So, but what we do know is that people who are darker skin colors, they need a lot more vitamin D. Yeah. And it's harder for your body to create that from just the sun. So you have to supplement and eat it from your diet, like oily fish, eggs, things like that. Now, remember that
some communities... Can I just ask a question about that?
Yes,
you said they need more vitamin D. Am I right in thinking it's not so much that they need more vitamin D, it's more difficult for them to get it because their skin screens it out. It doesn't... Yeah. Yeah, right. Okay, just checking.
The melanin optimizer protects your skin from creating the reaction to make vitamin D.
Thanks.
But there's also some evidence to show that they might need more because their body have got other genetic, they may have poor vitamin D transport. So, for example, I know that personally, when I've done my genetics, I've not got great vitamin D transport. So my diet's great. It's packed with vitamin D, but even so. And also that when it comes to illness, when people have had stress, they potentially may need more vitamin D because it's used as a cofactor in so many physiological reactions. Mm. So when we look at the Northern Europe and the UK and Sweden and all those places, we can only make vitamin D in the summer months, basically from April to October. So that cuts out half the year. So half the year, 90% of the UK is deficient anyway. And then secondly, as you shared, it's harder to make it. So you need to be out in the sun more. But if you are of certain cultures, you may be covering up because of your religion. You may, and that includes, not just Muslim people, all sorts of people. You also may not go into the sun because it may not be deemed attractive to get darker and get a suntan. Mm. There's all those things too. You may not be playing outside because from a socioeconomic perspective, you don't have the access to green space. So there's so many aspects of this vitamin D and cancer conversation. Mm. And this is just one example of the health inequalities. And, particularly during this COVID pandemic, we've become so aware of the haves and the have-nots and, the access to, nature has been so important. Yet those from poorer socioeconomic groups, which often overlap with the BAME groups and Black, Asian, ethnic minorities, that makes an impact as well on health as well. Because if you're not getting exercise in the same way, you're not having that nature, you're not having time for mental health, all of those things. Mm. So inequalities in cancer care, we can't blame them just on the genetics and not having awareness and not having access to the information or screening or any of those things. Although that information, having that information in different languages and be able to myth bust about it will be very useful and will help. But it's also the structural kind of components of these things and the distrust of screening and doctors, and because the people for years have not felt heard. So I'll give you an example. And this is just me, who's very educated. This time round, one of the doctors that I had, who was part of the surgical team, mm-hmm. and not my actual surgeon, one of his more junior people, she wrote the pathology report. For some reason, and we're still trying to work on getting to the bottom of this, First of all, she got the dates wrong on my previous reoccurrences. Completely wrong. I don't understand why, because everything's on my file. And secondly, she made an assumption that I'd refused treatment, because I hadn't had any other treatment before. She made an assumption, without looking at the file, that I'd refused treatment. Mm. And that was based on, I guess, my name. Now, that is an example of bias from our health professionals.
Yeah.
And this is a female surgeon who's actually married to someone of colour, because we talked about it afterwards.
Right.
And so... She just didn't get her own bias until we, and it, you know, this is very clear from, you know, the Euro footballs and like the vast amount of racism we've seen and, you know, towards the three kind of young players, that there is still quite a lot of bias that's unconscious in this country, whether it's football, whether it's cancer. So what we need to do is like break down this structural and systemic racism, because sadly people are dying because of it. Mm. Because if people don't know which doctors to go to or why they're getting screening, they don't trust the people, that they don't have systems that support their cultural needs. It's very difficult.
Mm. All right. So look, it's a big problem, but it's got lots of different elements to it, lots of different strands. And this is what I've heard from the other people I've talked to. There are strands within the culture itself which hold back progress and getting the same kind of opportunities. There are structural issues, as you described. And there are kind of role model problems whereby the people don't see people like themselves doing these things. So they just don't think it's for them. There's all these different things going on. And, you know, the prejudice is mixed in amongst it all. I'm absolutely shocked to hear that there's actually a genuine belief amongst, you know, us white people that black people don't feel so much pain. I mean, where did that come from? It seems that I can only believe it came from suppressing slaves for hundreds of years and treating them like animals, you know, and they're only black people. They don't feel it. You know, where on earth that would come from other than that, I couldn't think. But
no, so it actually does come from that. It comes from, to create slavery, they had to dehumanize black people and other, you know, people. So, and just assume they were like animals and not do that. And like, you know, we're not going to go into the history of, but I think the problem is we are a colonial, we were one of the biggest colonizers, the UK, and I'm here as a colonial, as a kind of part of the colonial empire. You know, my parents were born and brought up in Africa as part of the British Empire and moved here because of the British Empire. So, you know, there's all those things too, but we have to listen more. And what's interesting is the statistics show that women of colour have to go to the GP 2.3 times more, at least 3.3 times more, before they're diagnosed with cancer.
Mm.
So they're having to go more. And that's where they're not being listened
enough,
to.
As if it isn't bad enough already. Okay, well, look. Yeah, so what I wanted to ask is, look, as I was saying, there's all these different elements to it, all these different strands, different problems in a way, but they're all adding together into one, you know, bad result. So what steps in amongst all this do you think would have the most impact in addressing the inequalities?
Well, there's a lot to do. I think the government has a lot to answer for, and, you know, until they own that there's racism in this country, which the CUR report said there wasn't, which clearly there is. That's the first thing. The next thing is, you know, from a practical perspective, is data collection. What we really need to do is collect data, both at GP level and hospital level, particularly for different minorities. And we need to collect the data with various things. So when they're when the symptoms appear, when they're diagnosed. For example, when I had radiotherapy, the advice is that they give you, if you're going to have radiotherapy burns, they'll normally happen within the first week after treatment finishing. Now, I had burns, but not for 2 weeks after. So my question to both the radiotherapy nurses was, I've got more, and I'm really a light-skinned brown person, but would the melanin make difference? Because essentially, radiotherapy burns are essentially sunburn, like bad sunburn.
Yeah, yeah.
So surely the melanin means it could delay. And then she said that she's heard that anecdotally, but she's never collected the data on that. And I said, well, if you collect the data, then we'll know. So this is a missing. So again, with, you know, all of these things, some trusts and hospitals collect ethnicity data. Some people don't. Part of it's like, who's going to process it? But we do need to do that. And as clinical research, we also need to ensure there's diversity in trials as well and things like that. And that way we can provide a better service. I mean, there's a million things that we need to do, but for me, it starts with the data collection. Because when we collect the data, then we're able to figure out what we need to do, what the main problems are.
Well, good thinking. That makes complete sense. And, you know, it's something that I wouldn't have had an answer to at all if somebody asked me. Okay. Well, look, guess what? We're out of time. Your passion for that subject is quite obvious. And keep going, because, you know, obviously there's a lot to be done. And people like you are needed to actually come up with the ideas and drive it forward. So fantastic. Really enjoyed talking today, Toril. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, and I'm sure we will continue some of these conversations offline.
I think so. All right, very good.
Lovely to speak to you. Have a great evening. Yes. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you found that interesting. We have a comments facility on every Yes to Life show episode, so if you want to let us know anything about this or any other episode, do go to the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Click the link to the radio show that's on the homepage, and there you'll find all the past 300 plus shows. Click any one to leave a comment about that show. Alternatively, on the main radio show page, there's a link to leave general comments about the show. We're particularly keen to hear suggestions for topics or guests to include in the show. Thanks for listening. Do please join me again next week, same time, same place, for another Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.